next installment of the SUS News podcast series, where we interview newsmakers and discuss the news and applications relevant to the global unmanned technologies community. I'm your program host, Patrick Egan, and as always, let's say hello and welcome to our co-host, Mr. Gene Robinson.
Hello, Patrick, and how are you today on this fine day?
I'm good. I'm getting ready for Thanksgiving. Looking forward to a couple of days off. Gobble, gobble.
Yep.
You know, how about yourself?
Turkey. I am just lined up for the turkey, the whole fan map, the whole nine yards. I'm looking forward to it myself.
What do you think you'll be watching on Thanksgiving Day? Any reruns or anything?
The Macy's Parade, of course, but you know, that reminds me. One of the things that we have been remiss in doing, I managed to get on the Smithsonian Channel. If you will go and look at the Air Warrior series on drones, there are like five vignettes, and four of them are military, and the last one, but not least, is yours truly.
Well, interesting. And so did they do you, let's say, you know, sometimes some of these interviews and whatnot, let's say, aren't very flattering or whatever. How was the program?
Actually, these folks did a really good job. They were talking. The entire program was on the positive use of drone unmanned aircraft. And, you know, even though they were military, they talked about saving lives and the use of military assets out there in your neck of the woods and on the fires out there. And they did a really good coverage of the one search and rescue that we were on that seems to get all the attention, the young child in Liberty County. But I thought it was well done. It was probably one of the better ones that I've seen, you know, other than the first one that, Ma and Gus put on was the best. But it was a good one. I can't complain at all. It was a good depiction of how we can use drones for the good.
Well, that's cool. That's good. So people can check that out. I'm sure there's reruns of that or on demand or whatever else.
Yep, it's on the web. I think it's on the InnerTube now under the Smithsonian Channel, Air Warriors, so you can look it up. It's just the title is Drones.
Well, excellent. The other big one that's going on right now, or people are talking about, is the drone registration recommendations. And I know we've talked a little bit about it offline, and I've been talking to people offline about it, but I'm not encouraged. You know, I think it's a convoluted mess. I think that we were the only people that win on this deal are the FAA. I think two gifts were doled out. One, 250 grams as a risk threshold for drones, which is bad. And I can't believe that the people in the task force didn't ask the FAA to throw out the study that was used for shrapnel and projectiles from explosions. That correlates to plastic and foam drones. I don't get it. Comment, Gene.
Well, you know, at least at this point, we weren't firing frozen chickens at windshields. You know, that was the whole impetus behind a lot of the bird strike study that went on until they found out that the chickens were frozen because they wouldn't stay together coming out of the cannons. I think the 8-ounce, that whole 8-ounce threshold is a bit low myself. I don't know that there is anything in your local Best Buy or Target or mom and pops around the street department store that carries drones, which they all do, is going to weigh under 8 ounces. I don't know that it's going to relieve anything to have that many people trying to register drones. I don't know. And again, to me, they have also introduced the term toy to the whole discussion. If you'll recall, we had model aircraft and we had aircraft.
Right.
And they decided, well, you know, it's time. We're going to level this playing field. We're just going to call it aircraft. now we seem to have introduced this new term, toy drone versus a real drone.
Yeah, I don't think that's good, and I don't think it, also I don't think the published commercial baseline for mean time between failures now compared to unmanned aircraft, that was bad too. I'm talking to people in the industry. There are people that believe that there are going to be people that are going to live to regret having their name as part of that task force.
You think so?
I do. I think that was a big mistake. People that are advocating for this technology, you have people that don't know anything about the FAA, don't know anything about aviation, aren't engineers, and have no idea on how, let's say, the regulatory process works. These are big mistakes were made. We'll see what happens, though. Maybe I'll be wrong, and it won't be mistakes. It'll be great, but I have a feeling the next crisis is now going to be certification. You know, now that we're 250 grams, as the that presents a risk to both the NAS and people on the ground. But we'll see how it how that plays out in the future. I don't know. Anyway, today we're going to talk about Florida Automated Vehicle Summit with Gulf Inman System Center, Florida Atlantic University, and Pickett & Associates, and we have representatives from those. We have UAS Program Manager John Watts, and maybe, John, you're from Gulf Inman System Center. Maybe you could give us a little bio on yourself, how you got into unmanned technology.
Yeah, UAV Program Manager over at Gulf Inman System Center. Been in this pretty long time, since 2007, worked over for DOD, went into the private sector. I've actually ran across Gene, over at Autopilot International probably back in 2008.
Yep.
I don't think we like really talked, but I remember meeting you. But I've been in this, I got into it, by accident, and my mission since day one, when I got into DOD, they told me you're the least important part of this program and the least expensive part of this program, and I've been fighting to get that technology down to a price point to where it's available to create jobs here in the United States.
That's a good thing. That's good. Our next guest is Professor Carl Von Ellenreder from Florida Atlantic University. Carl?
I'm a professor in ocean engineering at FAU, and I've been mainly working on unmanned marine vehicles, mainly with unmanned surface vehicles, but also a little bit with underwater vehicles.
Excellent. You've been at this for a few years.
I've been here since 2003. And when I first started, actually, I was in aeronautical engineering way, way back in the late 80s. And I worked in a lab that was testing vehicles underwater to simulate weightlessness. So I've been kind of working in unmanned vehicles off and on for a pretty long time.
Interesting. And then our final guest is Greg Prather from Pickett & Associates. Maybe you can tell us a little about yourself, sir.
Yeah, I'm a registered professional surveyor in Florida, and I've been serving mapping field all my life, and our company has a complete aerial photogrammetry and LIDARs from a conventional. We capture all of that data from our Cessna 210, and then we also have a steady drone that we've been implementing into our workflow. And then the main focus of this topic here is our venture into the UAV on the water. We've been working with John to try to implement a robotic boat to do hydrographic surveys with.
Interesting. So, how did you guys all start working together?
So
John, anyway, I started working with John and Gussie actually fairly recently. This is Carl from FAU. We've been doing a project for the Florida Department of Transportation to look into developing systems to do unmanned surveys of bridges. So we'd be looking at the underwater components of the bridges using real-time imaging sonar.
Okay. And what's the Florida Automated Vehicle Summit?
Sorry, could you repeat that?
What is the Florida Automated Vehicle Summit? What is this? Can you tell us about it?
It's essentially a large conference that's sponsored by the Florida Engineering Society together with the Florida Department of Transportation. And it's a two-day event. And in the first day, it's sort of like an indoor session where there are many kind of discussions about unmanned vehicles in general, meaning, you know, automated vehicles on the road, in the water, and in the air. And there are several panel sessions where the technologies and some of the issues surrounding the vehicles are going to be discussed. And then on the following day, it's going to be very cool because on Tuesday, there are a series of outdoor demos of unmanned road vehicles, unmanned ground vehicles, off-road and on-road. I think Tesla's going to be there. There's going to be a Humvee from SWRI. And then there are going to be several aerial vehicles out there in another section, and then several maritime vehicles also doing tests and demos on the water. So it should be very exciting for anybody who wants to come and see that.
Interesting. And so, you know, it's kind of the converging technology idea with the land, sea, and air. They're all kind of automated systems or robotics, and we're just kind of all bringing those together and those people out of their silos to see what other folks are doing. Is that kind of a good summation of what's happening?
Yeah, to some extent. I mean, to some extent, a lot of vehicles have, you know, a bit of commonality in the way they're controlled and some of the issues that surrounds them in terms of, you know, their navigation when they're coming into contact with the general population. So, you know, there's definitely a lot of commonality and definitely a lot of things that can kind of be learned from the cross-fertilization of ideas between the different types of, I guess, the different domains that the vehicles operate in.
And, you know, that's, I guess, you know, be a fair question. People talk about public acceptance of robotics, and I personally see it as something where these are turning into more of, let's say, consumer products. We're getting more and more robotic type systems, and people are more accepting. Is that kind of what you're seeing? And you expect that most people will come out, or you can the general public or other people that are interested? I mean, who do you think is going to come out? And is that part of the goal, public acceptance?
I think so. I mean, you know, I think that's one of the one of the big pushes that Florida is taking. It's one of the first states in the U.S. that is, you know, kind of out at the forefront at trying to get automatic vehicles on the road. I don't know. I've been out to Mountain View, California, and you can see the driverless Google cars kind of going around Shoreline Boulevard and so forth. And Florida, I think, is one of three states, at least as of a few months ago, that actually permitted unmanned vehicles on the road, driverless cars on the road. So I think, you know, they're definitely trying to be at the forefront of getting the general population to accept these vehicles and also into looking for new applications for them. So, you know, the project that we're doing to look basically utilize the vehicles for bridge inspection is kind of one of those applications.
And so you're using, you're working with John, and you're using the, what kind of unmanned surface vehicle are you using?
So the vehicle that we're using is called, it's an acronym that's called WAMV. It stands for the Wave Adaptive Modular Vehicle, and it was designed by a company in Berkeley, California, called Marine Advanced Research. It's essentially a twin-hulled catamaran that has inflatable hulls, and basically, they sell these platforms. You can buy them in different configurations, but the one we purchased was essentially only the hardware, the mechanical hardware, and then we've outfitted it with our own propulsion system, communications, and automation and so forth.
And that's what the university will be demonstrating.
Yes, yeah. It's a 16-foot vehicle, about 8.5 feet wide, pretty heavy, about 450 pounds.
Interesting.
And it's got like a real-time imaging sonar boom that will kind of lower down in the water, allow you to kind of beam back live images of structures, say along the pier. There's several supports that'll be there, and we'll also probably put some targets down as well. So as the boat moves past the pilings and the pier, we'll be able to image those.
Interesting. And now, John, maybe you could tell me a little bit about, I know we talked offline, but you know, you're telling me a little bit about your project that you've been working on. You have a unmanned surface vehicle, and maybe you could tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, so Pickett & Associates contacted us, well, we had met them through an AUVSI convention over in Orlando, and we started a discussion about some of their needs and what they needed to be done. And, you know, they asked me if I could do it, and I accepted it. I said, yeah, I can do it, just from my past experience dealing with targets, doing maritime targets. And we've been working for probably about 120 days now. We've got a working prototype. It's all probably about 90% off-the-shelf parts. I did that from some of my background with dealing with SOCOM. I knew logistically it was better to do that. And we've got everything pretty much panned out with the system. It's got a range of probably about a mile over the water. There was a lot of propagation models we had to work through as far as with the RF stuff, a little bit of electrical engineering problems that we had. Some of the first issues that we had were some of the power issues with reverse, and we had to change up the system. But, you know, we did testing today, and we were at a mile, and we were able to get enough throughput to stream video and control two software packages at the same time. So it was pretty good stuff. Very impressive unit. It's cost-effective, and it's something I think that will be a good product for the market as far as hydro surveying.
And I guess the idea with this, too, you designed this using all COTS parts and pieces, and so did that, let's say, pay off in keeping the system, let's say, commercially viable?
Yeah, because of the logistics. You know, initially when I went into it, I was looking at, like, cannon plugs and things of that nature, and when I started looking at it, it was just so hard, and you had to be pretty much a supply person to figure out what to order. So we started looking at, just stuff that was from Home Depot, West Marine, Amazon, and things that were easy to track down and get within 2 days. And that was kind of where our decision process came in to develop it with some of the COTS stuff. Initially, you know, like I said, we wanted to use some of the military-grade stuff. But I went back to what I learned when I was in doing R&D, using off-the-shelf stuff. I mean, just logistically, it's a lot easier. And if you have a problem, you know, you're not out for 5 days. You're out for 2 days. And then, you know, hopefully you'll have a supply of that stuff, obviously. But, you know, a patch-out kit.
Yeah, I've run into some of the same issues. And it is nice if you can go to Home Depot or Ace Hardware or whatever and pick up parts and pieces and use them from there. So, I mean, you guys, and I'm going to talk to Greg, I guess, is the end user really on this, or the customer, but I wanted to talk a little bit about, I mean, you know, the experience that end user or customer comes to you and says, hey, we need these, let's say, capabilities, and then you as the person who did the design builder have these challenges to overcome. Was it pretty straightforward, or did you have some issues that you really were like head scratchers and that you had to overcome to meet the needs of the end user?
Is that towards Greg or me?
You, John.
Oh, sorry. Yes, there was. Some of the issues that we had as far as the RC stuff. You know, I come from a DOD background, so the RC stuff was a learning curve for me. Initially, what we had did, I'm a part-time instructor at Tallahassee Community College, so I looked at everything and I said, okay, I'm going to get this guy to engineer this, and it's not going to be a problem. I can figure it out. And that was what I found to be a little bit of a mistake, because the RC stuff is a little bit more complicated to deal with than turnkey, product that's built for just turnkey operation, if you will. So those were some of the challenges that we had. Some of the software integration and the integration of systems, as far as dealing with RF propagation models, those were challenges. Our boat is 9.5 feet long. So some of the antenna configurations we had to change around because we were getting some interference from some of the other systems, and we had to get rid of some other systems. But, you know, all in all, we've got everything working good, and it's working fine, and it's pretty user-friendly. It's just going to take a little bit of a learning curve as far as the training aspect of things.
Right. And then that kind of segues right to our customer end user, Greg. Maybe you can explain, Greg, how you used man boats and maybe what you're going to do in transition to, let's say, unmanned surface vehicles.
Yeah, so our concept of this boat is we want it to look and smell like a man boat, but we want to operate the boat from the tailgate of our pickup truck. And there are a lot of things that we do on our man boat that we had to automate, figure out how to automate on the robot boat, and we've got all of that stuff working now, and so we're overall pretty satisfied with where we're at in the development process.
And what do you think this is going to bring, like, advantages to the mapping community or the surveying community, the unmanned boat? What are the advantages using this from besides the manned boat?
So the main advantage or main focus of this is safety. Some of the water bodies that we survey now are the water is it's not a real safe place, and so my goal is to get my surveyors out of that water and on the land looking at everything that they would normally look at on the boat. They're looking at all of these things from the tailgate of the pickup truck, which is a much safer environment for them.
Well, now this environment, is it just because there's the water is toxic, or they're you guys are in Florida, there's certain animal considerations. What's the real safety risk, or is it just drowning from falling off the boat while working?
All of those, but the main issue is the toxicity of the water.
And primarily, what kind of work do you think you'll do with this unmanned surface vehicle?
The same work that we're doing now. With our manned hydrographic survey vessels. Hydrographic surveys of freshwater bodies.
Okay. Interesting. And are you also using have you considered using aerial platforms for your work?
Yeah, we do that every day. Again, as I mentioned earlier, we have a full service aerial survey shop already in place. We operate a 210 Cessna, and it's got a Orion LiDAR system in it and a digital camera. And we also have a steady drone.
Oh yeah, okay, you did mention that. I'm sorry. So yeah, how do you find the drone to work for your business?
Well, it's been a little bit of a challenge to get it where we want it to be. We're pretty close. We're looking at some topographic mapping applications and some inspection applications for the drone.
And do you see it replacing, the manned aircraft, or just another tool in the toolbox?
We don't see it replacing anything that we're already doing. We see it being a better way to do some things that are being done you know, with, like, for example, a bucket truck or an aerial lift or a crane or something like that. A cheaper and better way to do some of those things.
Mm, yeah, that's interesting. And that kind of falls in line with what we hear a lot here on the podcast when people adopt this technology. So I'm glad to hear that's working out for you. But I do, you know, I wanted to talk about RoboBoat and RoboX a little bit, and I'm going to address that to Carl. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about RoboX and the RoboBoat?
Sure. RobotX is it's an international competition that actually the last year was the first year it was held, and it was held in Singapore. And it's basically a competition where they put together at least at the first competition, there were three teams from five different Pacific Rim countries. So there was Japan, South Korea, Australia, Singapore, the United States. I think that's five. And basically, so these 15 teams were competing to basically complete an on-the-water obstacle course that involved basically vision-based navigation through static obstacles on the water. And then it also included trying to localize acoustic targets underneath the water. And so, you know, the challenge is actually quite difficult, and it encompasses a lot of the challenges that are sort of generally encountered in navigation and also in obstacle avoidance and things like that for unmanned surface vehicles. We're, you know, FAU has a combined team with Villanova, and so basically we have, last time around, we had about 17 students that we sent out to Singapore from across all the fields of engineering, pretty much. And RoboBoat is similar. It's just a smaller scale that's usually held in the summertime in Virginia Beach. And we usually go that one alone, so usually it's just a team of students from FAU. And it's very similar, but on a much smaller scale. And so, you know, it's again, it's a navigation through obstacle courses and things like this. This coming year's RoboX, which is going to be in December 11th in 2016, is basically also going to include a new challenge that requires us to deploy an underwater vehicle to perform certain, like, imaging tasks around this kind of like this stationary buoy. So it's pretty challenging, and it actually trains the students on a lot of the different facets, including things that are a little bit fuzzy, like team management and finance and so forth, as well as the hard engineering stuff. So.
Yeah, that could be tricky when you said you're sending all those students to Singapore. That could get costly real quick. But then also with the components and parts, are you guys rely on sponsors, or is there, you know?
We do, and if anybody is interested in donating, you're always welcome to, you know, we definitely appreciate your help. The easiest thing to do would be to go to our website, which is auvsiasv.fau.edu, and there are links from that page that go to our RoboX page, and this is actually our RoboBoat page because it's hosted by the AVSI, so we kind of use that as a way of announcing the website, I suppose. But we'd certainly welcome any support we can get, and it's basically going to STEM education for students and to give them a real-world working experience and to get them out there in the real world instead of just in class.
Oh, I like that. I like that idea, and it sounds worthwhile. That's a worthwhile effort. And then, John, why don't you? Do you have a website where people can see the project that you're working on, or the projects that you're working on?
We do not right now have that on the web. But if you want to visit us on the web, it's guscenter.com. It's GUSCENTER. .com.
Excellent. Well, you know, it was informative. We could learn some stuff about some surface vehicles and how they'll be used and whatnot. And I'd like to thank everyone for being on. It was informative. I learned a lot. Gene, anything in closing?
I think that the marine side of the autonomous craft are going to come on strong. I started to jump in there with several search and rescue things. I know people are tired of getting me, you know, keep talking about search and rescue, but, you know, there are times that it's just going to be better to send an autonomous boat out there. I get it. I totally get it.
Yeah, no, it's exciting, and you know, you guys will have to keep us informed, and maybe we can have you back after the competition, Carl, and hear what happened. But okay, well, thanks for being on the show, you guys, and we'll talk to everybody next during the next episode. Have a good day.
Have a good Thanksgiving, folks. See you.
Happy Thanksgiving, guys.